When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to Outward, Slate's podcast about the LGBTQs and all of the ways that those beautiful letters can be recognized under the law and in our great American system of capitalism. I am Jules Gill Peterson.
I'm Brian Lauder. That was such a great, yeah. All the ways that they can be commodified and sold back to us. I'm actually excited on that subject today to play a little dress up with you, Jules. I understand we're going to be putting on our legal eagle hats to talk about queers and trademark law.
I know. It's what everyone woke up this morning thinking I've got to hear about. But it's a really, really fascinating conversation. There's a lot bound up in it that I think is really exciting. I'm glad you said dress up because, like, it's true. I don't want anyone to think I actually love American capitalism or actually any capitalism. But I was also thinking about, like, because I'm famously not from America and from Canada,
famously
America's little stepchild, you know, what of the funny, like, legal dress-up things that I don't think we went all the way on this. So, like, you know, in England, you know, traditionally, like, the barristers, the lawyers have to, and judges and everyone in the court wears those, like, whatever, Edwardian wigs or whatever. And I think, like, for a long time, because when I was growing up, Canada was still a little more unselfconsciously devoted to white Anglo culture. I did think that that's what everyone wore in court in Canada. And then I remember in high school, I took a law class. And one of the assignments we had was we had to go sit in on a court case. And it was so fucking boring. Oh my God, going to court is so boring unless, like, you're there because you're in trouble, right. In which case it's terrifying. But I was just sitting in the gallery and I was actually so upset to find out no one was wearing those wigs. So I don't like Britain and I don't like the British Empire, and, like, the Anglo history of Canada is one of its worst, you know, violent histories. However, if we're gonna do the farce of law, maybe we should wear the wigs.
Powdered wigs. Yeah, we can do it. We should get some. We'll get some for our next legal interview, and we can wear them.
Well, we should just wear them when we're recording, and then listeners will be able to obviously tell
them. It'll add some gravitas to the whole enterprise, I'm sure.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, maybe to go find our powdered wigs. We'll try to get those together. And then we will be back to talk about queers and trademark law with Michael Goodyear. We're excited for that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Discover more than 60 add-ons every week. One of the meals that I had was mushroom chicken thighs and wild rice. To have something genuinely delicious and can be heated up in 2 minutes, I mean, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon. You can also customize your weekly meals, and you have the flexibility to get as little or as much as you need. Factor is also celebrating Earth Day all month long, so look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/outward50 and use code outward50 to get 50% off of your first box plus 20% off of your next box. That's code outward50 at factormeals.com/outward50 to get 50% off of your first box plus 20% off of your next box while your subscription is active.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail, and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle, and I've lost 20 pounds already, and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
If I say the words lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer, what are the first three things that come to your mind? But actually, no, sorry, please don't tell me. I'm not sure I want to know everyone's answers. But I am guessing that trademarked is probably not one of your first associations. Although LGBTQ branding has reached, I think, a pretty bizarre saturation point in our lives that we kind of now know both how to shrug it off in general, but also how to try not to cringe too hard at our favorite, hard seltzer brands' attempts to capture the niche queer consumer market every June. But there's actually a really fascinating reason for this sort of cultural and marketing sea change. It's that in a pair of decisions in 2017 and 2019, the Supreme Court, overturned an earlier legal regime in which trademarks were not allowed to contain slurs or anything deemed, quote, disparaging, immoral, or scandalous. Now, Michael Goodyear, who is a scholar based at NYU School of Law, recently looked into some of the effects of these decisions and sort of the rise of all these kinds of reclaimed slurs about sexuality and gender as actual registered trademarks. And he wrote a really fabulous article for Slate about it recently, which is titled "The Surprising Result of the Supreme Court Case That Allowed Slurs in Brands." And you know, since Brian and I are suckers for a good jurisprudence tale, not to mention the latest scoop on rainbow capitalism, we're just so delighted that Michael is joining us here today to talk about really what he found in the course of this research, and maybe more broadly, how we might think about this new apparent golden era of queer trademarking. So, Michael, welcome so much to Outward. Thank you for being here.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, as I said before we got started, I am also a professor. So, you know, you don't have to convince me that trademark law is a good subject for a conversation. But I kind of just maybe want to get us all up to speed on the genre and maybe just sort of the state of things before these Supreme Court decisions, because this is not an area of law that I certainly had known that much about. So could you maybe just remind us exactly like what a registered trademark technically is and sort of how a company broadly would go about getting one or why they would want one? And then specifically, why is it that, you know, until quite recently, you know, words like queer or homo or my personal favorite, transsexual, were not able to be trademarked?
Sure. So starting way back at the beginning, you know, if folks think about trademarks, we're thinking like Coca-Cola, Pepperidge Farm, these like quintessential wholesome brands. And we usually think of them as source identifiers, right? Mm. So the purpose of a trademark is that it's supposed to signify that where it's coming from. And we're knowing that if we buy a bottle of Coca-Cola, that will be a nice bottle of Coca-Cola that is the same product that we've had previously. Mm-hmm. And I won't bore you with kind of the scholarly tales of all the various rationales for that, but source identification is the main purpose. And if you get a federal registered trademark, and for folks that kind of see trademarks on the streets, you might see a little TM or the R with a circle. The R with a circle means federally registered. TM, that just says TM, is just kind of a common law trademark. So that's just you're claiming it by yourself.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, see, I did not know that.
Yeah.
So the little R with a circle is a fancy one, but federal, in addition to being a little bit fancier, it also has some benefits to go along with it. So you get nationwide rights. So that would be your trademark across the entire country, rather than just kind of whichever locality you might be working.
Mm.
And there are kind of some economic benefits that flow from that. So you might be, if you're a company, you could potentially be valued higher by potential investors because you have this national trademark. Others aren't going to try to use it and create similar products, which can be, you know, fantastic for you. It's also great if others are trying to use it, then you kind of have a better claim in infringement lawsuits. So if you go into litigation, you'll have better claims for it. Not that those TM, common law trademarks, don't have any value, but there are some kind of super benefits to having the federal registration. And generally what you need to be a federally registered trademark is that you have to be distinctive of products and serve as a source identifier. There are, however, some exceptions that are under the Lanham Act, which is the federal trademark law. So under the Lanham Act, it has a list of things that you can't do in your trademark. And until recently, some of those included being disparaging, being immoral, or being scandalous. And the issue with that is that certain types of words, certain concepts were treated as those three things. And especially because when applications go into the trademark office, they're not just going to the trademark office writ large, they are going before a specific examiner. And the examiner, right, well, they'll bring their own mores, their own viewpoints, their own lived experience into mm-hmm. those evaluations. And yes, they have a guidebook and they'll try to follow that to the best of their ability, but it's not any word that contains the, or any trademark that contains the word gay. We have to get rid of that. That won't be in there. Instead, mm-hmm. it just, we don't allow disparaging marks. And it would maybe provide a few examples. And an earlier study by some of my colleagues here at NYU, Jeannie Fromer and Martin Beebe, took a deep dive analysis on the immoral and scandalous portions and found that when examiners were denying trademark applications for being immoral or scandalous, they were doing it in wildly inconsistent ways. Hmm. So one examiner would say, oh, this word is totally fine. This is not disparaging or immoral or scandalous at all. And then the next one would say, oh, no, this is definitely problematic. We can't register this. Hmm. Even though it'd be the same word. And this is the problem. And mm-hmm. we've seen this, right, with kind of like First Amendment or favorite amendment issues in other regards as well, where you get these very subjective standards. And then it's, how do we think about what the cultural norms are here? How do we think about, you know, who is actually making the decisions? Do they have the right viewpoint? Do they have, are they able to find other viewpoints and be able to rely on those? And so part of the issue is, these examiners were deciding things in wildly contradictory ways. And naturally, and especially keeping in mind, this is all prior to 2017. So thinking about LGBTQ plus topics, mm-hmm. everyone immediately thinks sex. Sex is scandalous. Sex is immoral. Sex is maybe disparaging. And
if you're doing it right.
Yeah, exactly.
And so everyone, or at least these examiners, were in response thinking, these are not things that we necessarily want to register, mm-hmm. at least in certain cases. And that led to several denials. And kind of some of the initial impetuses were, we don't want like really bad words and bad things mucking up our trademark registry. So on one hand, we don't want sex and all that sort of stuff in there. But also, we don't want slurs, mm-hmm. and we don't want mm-hmm. the N-word put in there. We don't want the word fag. We don't want anything like that. And so it's a bit of a, we're going to have a nice, clean trademark registry that will only have nice things like Coca-Cola and Pepperidge Farm. But because they're not really looking at the intent of the potential applicant and mm-hmm. the registrant, that led to some weird outcomes where, yes, we don't want someone who is going to spew hatred to try to register something. So we don't want Westboro Baptist Church trying to register, write some sort of horrible slur against gay people.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if gay people themselves are trying to reclaim that slur, that seems like a much more positive use. Didn't necessarily matter, depending on which trademark examiner you found. This happened most famously with what is colloquially termed the Dykes on Bikes, the San Francisco Women's Motorcycle Contingent, which, you know, great organization. Yeah. They wanted to register.
Pride parades around the country have contingents usually.
Around the country, obviously started in San Francisco. Like just wonderful organization, but they wanted to register it because they became known as Dykes on Bikes. They wanted to register as a trademark. So as you said, going around the country, they could control that brand and you wouldn't get necessarily like a totally different Dykes on Bikes or having like Dykes on Bikes beer or other random uses.
Goddess forbid. Yeah.
So makes complete sense. You'd want to get a trademark. This is, there are ample newspaper sources from the early 2000s showing they were known as those.
Mm.
They had distinctiveness in the market. They could not get a trademark. And in fact, it took over 5 years just to get a trademark on their name. It involved hundreds of pages of exhibits and documents. They had over 2 dozen experts have to testify on how the term dyke was being used by people who were actually female identifying members of the queer community.
Wow.
Which was utterly ludicrous.
Huh.
And then the same thing happened a few years later when they tried to register their symbol, which was a triangle that included the text, Dykes on Bikes. And the same thing happened. And the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office again said, no, the word dyke is actually disparaging. We're not going to be allowing this on our register. Not necessarily the best state of affairs for things, but enter Simon Tam and the Slants.
Mm-hmm.
So great band. Simon is of Asian descent, as are his fellow band members. And they wanted to reclaim the term the Slants. And they played on this in a lot of their various music as well. The albums tried to play on these various slurs against Asian individuals. So one was called the Yellow Album, for example. And like very clear that they were trying to reappropriate this term, not at all trying to use it to disparage or be hateful in any sort of way. And they made it all the way up to the Supreme Court fighting for this and arguing that the disparagement bar under the Lanham Act should be unconstitutional. The Supreme Court agreed. And so Simon and the Slants were granted the trademark. And then we similarly, shortly thereafter, Dykes and Bikes also received their second trademark in the symbol. And so the disparaging mark fell away. 2 years after that, the Immoral and Scandalous bars, they were up at the Supreme Court in a case called Brunetti. And there, Eric Brunetti, an artist, a clothing designer, and launched a brand called, according to court documents, F-U-C-T. You can put those together and see what that would actually spell.
Oh my gosh.
And we don't want that word on our trademark registry.
Think of the children.
Exactly. It's always the children.
They're always reading trademark registries.
They are.
Very vulnerable.
It's a great read. But once that went up, Supreme Court said, for very similar reasons to the disparaging bar, this should also be considered unconstitutional. So the Immoral and Scandalous bars fell away as well.
This is where you sort of come in, right? So after these two cases happened, you undertake the study to see what's the result of that, right, in the marketplace. So maybe describe a little bit about, you know, how you undertook that study and what you looked at and what you found.
Yeah. So when I was in law school as a student, right after Tam had come down, before Brunetti had, and I was just fascinated by the Tam decision when I initially read it.
Did you own an F-U-C-T t-shirt?
I have not, but if any of my students would ever like to find one and buy one for me, that would be a great gift.
Let it be known.
I do have Simon Tam actually wrote a biography and autobiography, and I do have that in my office.
Nice.
I should buy an album or something. But yeah, so after the two cases came down, there was widespread concern of, oh no, the sky is falling.
Right.
The worst words of the English lexicon are now going to be registered as trademarks. And we're going to be walking in the street and we'll see the N-word, the F-word, everything, everywhere. That did not come to pass, as you may have gathered when you walk down the street and go online. However, it was a really interesting question. I thought about this even when I was a law student. And in 2020, an Australian scholar, Vicky Wang, wrote an article about racially oriented slurs and how they had fared as trademarks after the Tam decision. So a few years after Tam, and the early signs were a little bit mixed on the race side. Native American slurs were still being used more in disparaging ways than in reappropriative ways, a little bit differently for African Americans. It had kind of stayed the same in overall numbers of uses of those slurs, but it had flipped from being mostly disparaging to now being reappropriative. So at least for those communities, there were positive signs that TAM had at least maybe not facilitated this, but at least had not stopped this change from coming about. Part of the kind of wrinkle with the racially oriented marks, however, is that there's just so much racism in branding. And I mean, not hard to think about, especially in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, all of these brands removing their racist brands. And Aunt Jemima went away, the brand of Land O'Lakes went away, and all of those kind of disappeared. And there are some great studies on those aspects as well from legal scholars. But with queer brands, it's a bit different because everything queer is kind of taboo before. We weren't seeing the same sort of kind of disparaging queer icons as brands. That wasn't really a thing that we did in the same way that we did against especially Black or Native American individuals, Latinx to a lesser degree. So it doesn't really have that same
sort of history. Like a flouncy gay syrup.
I wish there had
been. Yeah, and you know what I mean?
I actually would buy that syrup.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure it'd be delicious. But yeah, just to your point, there wasn't that kind of branding happening in the same way.
No. Yet. It was just completely taboo. So it's almost a little bit like there was a blank slate of no one wanted to touch this. And I think that did contribute to what I found in my study. So I undertook and looked at 11 historically used slurs against LGBTQ plus individuals. And some of them in various states of kind of reclamation. So some like queer, a bit more accepted now. Others are a little less so, like fag. But working through those, I quite surprisingly found, so I looked at an overall 9-year period, looking at 4.5 years prior to TAM, 4.5 years after TAM, seeing kind of what the state of affairs was prior to TAM, how these words were being used in trademarks, if at all, and then how they were being used after TAM and then after Brunetti. And shockingly, in both periods, I could not find a single actually disparaging use in any cases by an out-group member trying to use it to hate. Instead, the vast majority and all of them that I could find any actual information on were all used in reappropriative ways, trying to either be by or for the LGBTQ plus community. There were about 20 or so out of the 144 that I couldn't find kind of what they were intending to do. Most of them were what we term an intent to use trademark. So you might have an idea, you haven't really done anything with it yet, you want to lay claim and say, no, this isn't going to be my thing.
It's like my website domain that I've never built the website for. Yeah.
Exactly. And you have a few years and, you know, you can try to build up that business.
Sure.
They clearly just didn't go anywhere. So you couldn't really tell what they were intending to do. Completely possible. Some of them might have been trying to be disparaging. Also possible they could be trying to be reappropriative. But out of all the ones that actually went somewhere, even if they were ultimately denied registration, they were all reappropriative. And that was shocking to me. I thought that would be the trend, but I didn't think it would be 100%.
Even before the court decision. So in that sense, the court decision didn't seem to have a huge effect necessarily? Or am I understanding that right?
I don't think it had a huge effect on switching disparaging to reappropriative, as Vicky found in her study on racially oriented marks. I do think it had an effect on applications and registrations. So on the application side, we saw way more applications after TAM. And there are about 40 in the pre-TAM period, about 100 in the post-TAM period.
Were excited to,
People were excited. I think it's hard to say how much of a direct impact TAM had on folks wanting to apply, despite some terrible laws that are being considered in various states around the country. Obviously, we do have more LGBTQ plus rights than we did even a decade ago. And that has certainly been one aspect that has really helped. And other scholars have found this in the past as well, that often if there's kind of a rise in civil rights and civil rights movements, that tends to lead to greater self-expression and reappropriative efforts as well.
Before we get into some of the analysis, I was curious if you just had any of the trademarks that emerged after the court decisions that really amused you or that you just liked personally. You list some great ones in the story for Slate, but I'm curious if any stuck out to you as particularly inventive or surprising.
Yeah, there were a lot. It's a little hard to pick favorites necessarily. One of the ones I think the image made up in the Slate article The Queer Agenda, that's a card game. I think the tagline is like a queer AF game.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the little graphics on the box include like eggplant emojis and some stars and lightning bolts. It's just very amusing to me and very mm-hmm. colorful, which is one of the reasons I chose it as one of the images
mm-hmm.
to put in the Law Review article and in the Slate article. So initially, I was getting feedback from some other scholars that were like, so this is great, but you just have a bunch of charts and numbers, yet you have all these like great
missing
queer brands. Right. Like, put some images in
Where's
there.
Gay culture?
So I feel like that just does a great job of kind of encapsulating some of the bit of gay culture. And one thing with the trademarks as well, we often think of them as being more for goods, like the Coca-Cola bottle or this card game.
Right.
They can also be for services. And the services might not necessarily have images or photos in that sort of way. It's like there were a few like entertainment services, podcasts, that sort of thing that we're using and trying to reappropriate these slurs. They didn't necessarily have like the fancy graphics that the card game did.
I was particularly fond of, you mentioned Butch Appetit, which is a dating app.
Yes.
The other one I love. Oh, and
that one really got me, though, because I was like, I'm such a fucking homosexual. I was like, where's the slur? Appetit? Like, because it's French. I was like, oh, Butch? Oh, that's supposedly that was a disparaging term? Wow. Not where I come from.
Yeah.
Woo! Yeah.
Social mores.
I also love that.
Two
Hungry Homos is a cooking show. It reminds
me. Yes, I love that one, too.
We had a show that we used to do as part of Outward years ago called Ask a Homo. And I didn't even know that we were, you know, in this territory to some degree. We were reclaiming that term, you know, also. Totally the same vibe.
I love it. Well, we're going to take a short break here, but when we come back, we'll be chatting more with Michael Goodyear about the queer history of trademarks.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
And we are back. It does seem like there's something much broader going on in which reclamation of language is pretty like specific in terms of LGBT, you know, businesses, but also just like culture more broadly, right? It doesn't quite parallel or necessarily line up with the way different racial minorities and ethnic groups are thinking about those questions because of that, obviously, that historical difference. Like you were saying, we didn't have Twinkle Toes syrup or whatever going back historically. So like reclamation had to be more like the word that a psychiatrist or a judge would say, right? Or someone would yell at you. Mm-hmm. And that's a very... I mean, it's really interesting to me because also the sense of injury is quite different, right? Like racial slurs are tied to like an often legally codified system of unequal citizenship or, you know, servitude, right, or colonialism, whereas like gay and, you know, gendered and sexual slurs are not necessarily coincident, right, with that kind of long-term, centuries-long, right? They're often really quick generational shifts and changes. So I think that's really fascinating. But it also has something to do, right, with commodification. And I was just thinking about, you know, that has to do with something as subjective, but also market-driven as taste, right? What do people think is in good taste? Also, maybe like both what individuals, but what also corporations think will sell, right? And what has sort of like that basic claim to authenticity, right? And I'm just sort of curious. I mean, like I don't know why the prototypical example, I don't know why I'm thinking about this, is just seltzers. Like because we're in, maybe because we're, I feel like we're in this weird oversaturation period with beverages. Every time I go to the store, I'm like, why are there 75,000 water brands? Like, who fucking cares? Who's making all this money off of water? And why am I paying so much for water?
Water with a splash of fruit juice. Yeah.
Right. That, yeah, gosh, they really got me. So I'm just telling on myself. But I was like, you know, if I went in June, right, to the store, to the bodega, and saw like, you know, Dyke juice, you know, Boy Water, and like, and like Doll Spritzer. Like, I'm not sure what I would do with that information, right? Like, in terms of branding, it is an interesting, like, new realm, but I'm just sort of trying to think more about, like, I'm just sort of curious from your perspective, kind of knowing why it is sort of just practically speaking what the incentives are, right, to get a trademark. I mean, yeah, what do you think is sort of at stake here beyond, obviously, some of it's about making money and it being like having a successful business. Yeah. But like, what else seems to, or what is attached to that? I think what's interesting is how other things are getting folded into just like a very naked capitalist, like, oh, it turns out market research says that, you know, gay men, white gay men with a college degree in their, you know, early 40s like low alcohol seltzers. So let's give them, you know, Daddy Boy seltzer or whatever. But like, what are some of the things that you think are kind of being bound up in this that we could think about specifically through like the lens of trademark?
I think one really interesting aspect of trademarks is that, you know, we can think of them as this commercial aspect, and this is what the initial scholarship on trademarks said, like, no, this is saving you time because you can go to the grocery store and you'll see all these bottles of seltzer, right? And you're like, no, I like the Boy Juice one. I'm going to get that one.
Yeah.
Or no, I want Dyke Juice. Like, yeah. Whichever one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go back time and time again, rather than having to think, oh, there are 75 types of seltzer. How do I possibly choose? That it's certainly still part of it, but some scholarship around the turn of the century really showed that there's also this semiotic function that's going on. Mm. So it's also symbolic, it's content in a way, and this is why the Supreme Court found it to be kind of a First Amendment issue, that it's not just commercial, but it's also having some sort of communicative value. Mm-hmm. And I think that's especially important in the LGBTQ plus community. And I think, Jules, you hit on it perfectly earlier when you were saying, it changes like queer culture changes rapidly,
yeah,
it's changing over time. We, obviously, being queer, it cuts across all these other intersections of life.
Yes.
And if you were born rich or poor, white or black, like, it doesn't matter, you could be queer. And I think because of that, it's even more important for the queer community to have these various source identifiers and be able to think, what are these, whether it's just like a meeting place, whether it's a podcast, a product, how do I find things that reflect queer culture and culture that I maybe want to be a part of, am a part of? And I think that's really important. And so the sort of issues with those disparaging, immoral, and scandalous clauses were particularly problematic for the queer community. And I think with reviewing these various trademark applications, some of these are maybe more commercially driven. Others are kind of more community-driven, and they're, this is a podcast for queer Black women, or this is a podcast for, or this is a cooking show just happened to be by, like, two gay men. And some are more about their identity, some are more about trying to reach an audience, compared to just being purely about commerciality, where, of course, we see that every June, where everyone gets a rainbow flag, which has its own fascinating trademark story. We're not really, I think it has a very kind of different valence compared to what we might see with even the racially oriented marks or just trademarks more generally.
Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, you that is sort of a segue, I think, to the last point that you bring up in your piece, which is one thing we should sort of watch out for is people, if I'm going to paraphrase you, but people sort of trademarking things that belong to the whole community, right?
Yeah.
So something like, maybe not Dykes on Bikes, but something like that, that sort of is kind of spread around like the queer world, but also has a specific group like the one in San Francisco you mentioned. You sort of warn us that we need to keep an eye on, you know, people not owning something. It also reminds me of the recent dust up around, I think it was the chef David Chang trying to like trademark chili crisp. And then everybody, a lot of people in his community were like, can't, like, that's terrible. You can't take that away from all of these other cooks and companies. And so I'd love to hear you just speak a little bit about that mm-hmm. concern that I think you rightfully sort of leave us with.
The Momofuku chili crisp example is perfect and is a great segue. Certainly not being Asian is not myself, but living in New York City and going to many Chinese restaurants, like you always just ask for chili crisp or like chili. Like, it's right. Kind of crazy seeing folks be like, oh, maybe this is a term of art. It is not. It is. It's just what you asked for if you want it to be spicy. I think rightfully, right, Momofuku backed down and said, okay, like, we recognize our bad, something kind of less in this sort of valence, but the Taco Tuesday dispute that happened between Taco John's and Taco Bell, had some celebrities involved. Like, that was
two feuding houses.
Yeah.
One of them better because they say a Taco Tuesday for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Thankfully.
Which now they remember them. But growing up in the Midwest, we had both. Weirdly, tacos come up a lot in trademark law. Who knows why?
Something very American about that.
Yeah.
And I mean that disparagingly.
Okay. Even a Supreme Court case is literally about a taco.
Oh my God. We've got to have you back on to talk about that.
But going to the queer side of things, there is this concern where if you own a trademark in something, you actually are legally obligated to police your rights in that trademark. Otherwise, you could lose the trademark.
Oh, interesting.
It could become generic. And this is one concept of genericide, where if it loses, great term, right? Sounds terrible.
I love that.
But it's something that brands fear, because if you become not really a source identifier anymore and you just think of it as the product, you could potentially lose the trademark.
Mm.
And so with any of these queer brands or queer slurs that are being adopted into trademarks, they have to police it or potentially lose it. So the concern here is that if folks are policing too aggressively, they might actually, instead of reclaiming these terms for the community, reclaim them for themselves. Then other folks wouldn't be able to use the term queer in commerce, or they wouldn't be able to use dyke or butch or any of these other terms, which could be quite problematic. And kind of a very early example of this is with the now ubiquitous rainbow flag, which we see everywhere. But when it was first created in 1978 by Gilbert Baker, Gilbert very much intended it to be a symbol for the community, and everyone should be able to use it freely. And unfortunately, the organization that he was affiliated with at the time, the Gay Community Center in San Francisco, decided it wanted to try to trademark it. And if they had trademarked it, then they could enforce anyone else using the rainbow flag for any sort of gay parades or entertainment purposes.
Right.
Almost all the purposes that you use it for, I guess, except for corporate logos now. And yeah, so Gilbert fought back and had excellent legal counsel, and they ultimately got this community center to back down, and that's why it's not trademarked today, and anyone can use it, and you see it everywhere in June, and occasionally in other months. And yeah, so hopefully folks will follow Gilbert's example, and if they are trying to use these terms and try to reclaim them and make them symbols of the LGBTQ plus community, that they will actually do that and not over-police these terms and just stick to whatever the core area is that they're trying to use, rather than writ large claiming them.
Well, as we all famously know, queer plus police equal very, very bad. So yeah, no, definitely something to think about there.
Me too. Totally.
Just utterly fascinated. I feel like I actually understand trademarks a little bit better now, but also have a whole new way to think about. Ooh, I'm just had a prehensive moment about the fact that June is only a few months away. But anyways, you know, that's about all the time we have to chat about this for today, but just a reminder to listeners, definitely go and read Michael's piece up on Slate, The Surprising Result of the Supreme Court Case that Allowed Slurs in Brands, which we'll link to in the show notes for this episode as well. But Michael Goodyear, thank you so much for coming and talking to us about the minutiae of law, but also a delightful history of so many weird brands that now I'm going to be thinking about for a long time.
No, thank you so much. Really appreciate being on.
All right, that's the show for this week. Please send us feedback, topic ideas, advice, questions to ourpodcast@slate.com or via Facebook and X at Slate Outward. We always like to remind you that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like Working, and you will never hit a paywall on the Slate site. I will personally ensure that no paywall descends upon you on the Slate site if you join. And you could join by going to slate.com/outwardplus. Our show was produced by the incomparable Palace Shaw. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app. Tell your friends, family, lovers, enemies about it. Rate and review the show so others can find it. Until next time, Jules, I'll see you soon.
Stay gay, but also untrademarked.
Untrademarked, yes. We are staying gay is not going to be trademarked.
Bye, Brian. Bye.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.